Hello and welcome to Crosstalk. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we discuss some real news. There is talk, and maybe only talk, Ukraine is interested in a negotiated end to the conflict. What does Trump have to do with this? Also, would a Harris administration take a different position on the Gaza genocide? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Stephen Gajic in Belgrade. He is a research associate at Belgrade's Institute of European Studies. And in Lisbon, we have Alexander Guerrero. He is an international legal analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Stephen. You know, it's interesting, over the last, I'd say, 2 weeks, we've had a lot of different noise being made, if we can call it that. We had a Vatican envoy to Kiev, and Zelensky saying this war must come to an end. We had Viktor Orban being a real globetrotter, going to Kiev, going to Moscow, going to Beijing, and then to be shunned when he got back to Europe. And then, curiously, we have Trump still saying that he can end the war before he's inaugurated if elected. We have preciously little information on that. And then we had some of the likes of Mike Pompeo show up at the Republican National Convention, basically wanting to double down, triple down, quadruple down, completely at odds to what Trump seemingly has said. But there is something going on here, and I think it has to do with the American election. Your thoughts?
Exactly. It has to do with the American election, but also with the American grand strategy, because the Americans they've realized over the last 2 years that they cannot lead two major wars or be behind two major wars at the same time. So what we see with the possible Trump return might be that they want to shut down the Ukrainian, the Eastern European conflict for a while, and to completely concentrate on Netanyahu's plan to conquer the Middle East or to spread the war. So what is really important is the message that Netanyahu sent to the Congress. It is also very important that a lot of congressmen did not come, but still, he had a very warm welcome after 10 months of killing of civilians and some militants. So I think that Trump and the West in general wants a stalemate in Ukraine, which I don't think that the Russians are going to fall for that. So their whole game, I think, in a way, is based on several completely false assumptions. They are behaving like Wall Street brokers, assuming that some things are going to happen. For instance, assumption number one is that Russia wants to negotiate. First of all, Russia does not have with whom to negotiate, because after May 20th, it does not recognize Zelensky as a legitimate president. Now, after 28th of August, Rada, the parliament of Ukraine, also won't be a legitimate body to negotiate with. So who are they going to negotiate with? Why would they want to negotiate before the end of the goals that they have set? And so this is assumption number one that is based, I don't know, on what, apart from the racist thought that Russia is going to bow to the white gods from Capitol Hill and Brussels and do whatever they like and please. So that is one thing. What we hear constantly from people in the West is that the current line of division is going to be the future border of a North-South Korea kind of a settlement. Where did they get this story from? So that is one thing. We will see what happens, because I'm sure there's a lot of tension in the U.S., not maybe about the grand strategy, but about how to do that, because you have four American deadly enemies coordinated. You have Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And you have the American military as a potential. Okay, what military is going to lead this war? So I honestly don't know what really.
One thing is for sure is that the client state. Let me throw this to Alexander now. The client state, Ukraine, sees the real possibility that there'll be a change of power. In the White House, at least, maybe not in the bureaucracy, and that they want to hedge their bets. I mean, they're obviously see themselves in a very, very weak position. If you look at the news about the financial situation, that it isn't given enough coverage in the West. I mean, Ukraine is broke. I mean, and badly broke. And there's no, you can the interest from Russian assets, you know, 1.3 billion here, 1.4 billion. That's not going to change their financial situation in Ukraine. But it's really interesting to me is that because of the potential change of administration, you have people that are saying this is Biden's war. Let's wind it down. And then you have like people like Mike Pompeo that, oh, this is really what we want to go back to a Reagan foreign policy. There's a lot of different things going on at the same time. What are your thoughts?
Exactly. So first, let me remember once again that Ukraine is not only broke financially, is broke politically, demographically, is no longer a sovereign state since some time ago. And at the present moment, it is more than a failed state. It almost looks like Somalia is the same style, but in Europe. So it's no longer a matter of financially, of sponsorship. It has nothing to do with it. It has at the present only to do with the future of a country and what country are we going to have in a matter of 2-3 years. So what Ukraine are we going to have, if any? So this should be the point to be discussed presently. Then at the same time, I think that we should focus on the very specific aspects of American politics, because as we all know, the president of the United States has limited powers. He relies a lot on the Congress. And I believe that it was due to this that Mike Pompeo came to public to give this kind of interview, starting to put pressure in Donald Trump. But at the same time, if we remember some of Donald Trump's speech more or less 6 to 7 months ago, he was defending and supporting the decision of a land lease to Ukraine. Now he wants to put an end to this. But what kind of end does he want to put to? We know that he can approve, he can adopt several executive orders, but no more than that, he will need the support of the Congress to make it pass any kind of plan or project for the Ukrainian war presently, which I have to remember, it's a long-term war in Ukraine since 2014. So it's not only concerning Russia. This plan must cover at the same time aspects of all the Ukrainian resistance, which is presently no longer not only active, but is way too strong in order to put Volodymyr Zelensky against the wall and make him at least accept any kind of peace deal if the West just steps aside, leaving Ukraine alone. So no longer Ukraine has enough power to have a war, to have a say on this conflict. So
I don't think they've had a say for a very long time. Stephen, the variable, or people like to say the 800-pound gorilla in the corner, is quite visible, and people in the West and policymakers ignore it. Russia has already presented numerous times a starting point for negotiations. Now, obviously the Ukrainians aren't happy about it. Their patrons in the West are not happy about it. But it is a starting point, and that is a way this conflict can come to an end. But until the West recognizes the terms and conditions of starting negotiating, this is not the end game. This is the beginning game. Go ahead, Stephen.
Russia doesn't have any incentive to believe that the West is going to stick to any word or any deal, because they had Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 and the Normandy group. And I mean, everything, all diplomatic arsenal was out there. And starting with the deal that the Yanukovych signed that lasted for with the Western countries, and it lasted for less than 24 hours. So I don't think that Russia is really motivated at this point, where it has a really huge leverage in the conflict. What I don't get is this discrepancy between what the West wants and what it can do, what the collective NATO, let's say, wants and what it can do. So maybe the whole, change in Washington from Biden to Trump, from Democrats to Republicans is to have a fresh start, let's say, in this ongoing global war. I have to say,
yeah, I mean, but Stephen, I think I agree with you. And the fresh start, let me throw this to Alexander now. The fresh start should be reframing this conflict completely. And that reframing is pan-European security architecture. That's actually a face-saving measure as well, if you think about it. It's like, how do we, okay, we can all disagree on how we got here, but we, at the end, we have an end game where everybody has the indivisibility of security. I know that's a hard sell for Western politicians, because they don't even know what the word indivisibility of security means. But I think that is a starting point. Alexander.
It should be, but please remember that we have the so-called rules-based order, which, according to Western concepts and ideologies, means that whatever Washington says, it must be followed by all other Western European countries. So it should be an indivisibility. It also should be, it should prevail, the principle of sovereign equality. This is not only a customary principle in international law, it's also enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations. So therefore, I think that all this should be taken as a starting point. But when we listen to the speeches of Ursula von der Leyen, even during this week, suggesting that she wants to arrest and to sell and to deliver all the money from Russian assets to support Ukrainian military effort, I don't think that we are getting any place like that in the meantime, because they just want to pursue, they just want to feed the war machine. And when we at the same time listen to the Democrats, to Democratic Party, the alternative, which allegedly should be Kamala, first, she lacks charisma, then she lacks ideology. She's changing her opinion depending on to where the wind blows.
But Alexander, isn't that the perfect vessel for the deep state? I mean, she's there, winning candidate. Oh my goodness, a blank sheet, okay, with no charisma. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with our team.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Y'all probably heard my little sister story, Kaylin, the model girl that had got killed. Y'all probably seen it all over the news on 7030. Man, she got shot in the drive-by shooting.
My brother Terrell, he was shot and killed while helping a friend unload drugs into the church. So now I never look at churches as being a safe ground.
I got shot and lost my leg. That's the outcome of it, but everything's still the same. Ain't nothing changed.
The Chicago police is the biggest gang in Chicago. It's like, you get pulled over by police, you literally think your life is over, man.
That's another crime scene. Another one lost. Oh, this could have been a doctor, a nurse, could have been the next president. But we can't keep losing our people out here.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez. And I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to Crosstalk. I'm Peter Lavelle here. We discuss some real news. All right, let's go back to Stephen. Kamala Harris is the big name in the news right now. I think it's really interesting how quickly everyone's forgotten Joe Biden. That'll be something for the history books to discuss, okay? The reason why I wanted to talk about, you know, she met with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, when he was on his American tour that was cut short. You know, she said that she will not remain silent, which, you know, wow, it sent, you know, shockwaves around the ecosystem of those whose support Israel and its genocidal conflict in Gaza. But, you know, it's really interesting to me is that, you know, virtue signaling isn't going to do the trick here. OK, I mean, so much of American politics is about that. But there are a number of people, and you know, it could be 2-4% of the electorate, but that could make the difference in an election. They're not on team genocide. So Kamala Harris, as we mentioned in the first part of the program, you know, lacking charisma, lacking in knowledge, but empathy isn't going to get her the votes that she needs. Let's put it that way. Go ahead, Steve.
Exactly. Whole campaign looks to me, I mean, judging by the first video that we've seen, it looks like a big, you know, Coca-Cola company ad. It's very corporate. It's only virtue signaling. And then the language that she uses, she said that she knows the type of guy that Trump is. I mean, what is that supposed to mean? It's really interesting. I mean, because the Democratic Party has a big, I would say, ideological problem, and it's going to do some soul searching, I think, even after this election, because a large portion of its, especially young voters, are completely against the supporting. I wouldn't say only Israel, but specifically Netanyahu's policies, which are quite harsh, and even Benny Gantz would say suicidal for Israel as a state. So I think that her campaign and what would she do if she ever got elected, which I really doubt, are two completely different things. And the very fact that at the end of the day she met with Netanyahu is speaking volumes. So I think the main problem here for the Americans is how to assert the dominant position that they are losing, that they are not having anymore, and how to lead two or perhaps in the future three major conflicts at the same time. So what they maybe want to do, I've been saying this from the beginning, is to pause one so that they could accelerate the other. But I also don't know how is that possible, because if, let's say, Israel escalates with Lebanon, possibly with Iran and the other countries, and if the American cavalry comes, where is the end game to this conflict? Solely looking at the numbers, what is to come out of it? And I think that the answer to this question doesn't have neither of the, I wouldn't say candidates.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's really interesting is that I agree with you. I mean, there's no strategy here. There are a lot of tactics involved, but there's no strategy. And that's why it's flailing. And when we look at the conflict in Ukraine and obviously the shameful American backing of Israel's genocidal campaign in Gaza. Alexander, I mean, the fact that someone like Kamala Harris would say that, you know, she expresses empathy for what's happening to the Palestinians, but that is actually an act of cowardice, because, you know, the chief executive of the United States has enormous power when it comes to a support of an individual country like Israel, but she won't exercise it, okay? And she saying that she will not be silent shows an admission that, well, she might talk about it, but policy isn't going to change.
There's something weird about all this, you know, Peter, for one simple reason, is that Kamala Harris is part of the Biden administration for the last 4 years. They have been totally supportive of Israel along all these years. What has suddenly changed besides the fact that now she needs to present to the public a different speech? She must not forget that in the United States, it's all about the donors. Don't forget who toppled Joe Biden. It were the donors only. They toppled Joe Biden. Don't forget about all the news saying donors no longer support Joe Biden. Donors are asking Joe Biden to step down. So it's all about an elite. And at the same time, forget national polls. We have to focus on the swing states. And presently, Kamala is losing big time all those polls in the swing states. So it comes up only to these elements. She needs to present to the public a totally different speech. Don't also forget that Kamala is pretty unpopular among the Afro-American elite communities. So she needs to bring something completely different because she knows she has been part of the problem over the last 4 years. She supported blindly all the solutions brought by the Biden administration. She is the Biden administration. So we can't forget that this change in her speech. I believe that the press should put some pressure on her, at least to ask her what kind of solution does she support? Because coming to the public saying, I wanted
you,
to...
Alexander, you're thinking like a lawyer, okay? You are, okay? Because Stephen, I've already watched the media coverage here. Oh, this is such a tongue bath. It's unbelievable. I said after the undemocratic coup against Biden, I just said, buckle up and brace for impact. You're going to see the greatest makeover in such a short amount of time in history, and we're seeing it right now. Okay, like I've said, it's remarkable how Joe Biden has just been disappeared. I mean, he's gone. Okay, and we have a new administration that's an incumbent. It's really amazing what they're doing. Okay, but as Alexander pointed out, you know, it's basically Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and then within those states themselves, it's certain congressional districts. That's where she has a huge problem. And that's what the makeover challenge is all about. Go ahead, Stephen.
Exactly. I mean, the whole procedure of getting from Biden to Harris was completely an undemocratic procedure, because previously Biden got the support of the Democratic Party. And then all of a sudden, they all get scandalized and realize after 4 years that he is indeed dementia, and they realize that only during the debate. But this probably wasn't the worst, let's say, the worst appearance of Biden in general. I mean, he had some really good moments before the debate. And it seems all of a sudden that they were coordinated in the effort to get him out of the picture and put Harris, which I mean, we can build and try to figure out several theories why is that, and whether there is a new consensus about the Trump 2.0 that should you know, make this fresh start with the conflicts, maybe try to appease the Russians but there's also the second false assumption with that is that Russia, if it settles for whatever peace that the West wants to settle for, it will not help Iran. Russia has already signed and is already coordinated in defense with Iran, with Syria, with North Korea, with China, with India, potentially, Pakistan, and many other players in the...
Well, but Stephen, you know what you're describing? You know what you're describing? And, you know, I've talked about this on this program before, is that we've been told that we were on the verge of a third world war. I would posit to both of you, we're already in the third world war.
Exactly.
It's already started.
Yeah, exactly. We are in the Third World War, and the only question is how to frame it, how to sell it. And what is good about Trump is that he was always a good salesman. So one of his talking points is that if I win, I will stop the Third World War. What he's saying is I will settle a deal with Russia and focus on other parts, because the major problems from economy to global security are not going to be settled with one peace deal. I think that the best what the Americans can achieve at this moment, but I don't think they have the rationale or that this whole powerhouse wants to, has any incentive to do that, is to move to the historical example of the concert of great powers that came after the Napoleonic Wars. But unfortunately, I don't see neither side in the American, let's say, political or power spectrum rooting for.
Yeah, but see, Stephen, that's one of the major ongoing motifs of this program is having rationality, and because the global South understands geopolitics. The West is a purity test, and that's why it doesn't work. Alexander, Stephen is absolutely right. I mean, I don't want to be trite or anything, but when we look for a win-win here, no, the West will not allow that. They will not, because for ideological reasons, Alexander.
Of course not. They want collapse of Russia and of all the bloc that presently is on the same side as Russia. They have a mentality according to which they have to prevail. They want total full capitulation from Russia and its allies. As simple as this. They don't want to live in a peaceful way along with Russia and all other countries. They want to prevail. They want to impose their ideals, and they want to impose their principles. Sadly, it's as simple as this. They don't know how to live along with any other different species, along with other cultures. They don't know how to do it. That's why they are so allergic to wording like a pluralistic world, also to monopolarity is what they do support. They
In closing here, America first means whatever you want it to mean in the United States. And that for most people, it means more hegemony. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Lisbon and in Belgrade. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Rostock rules.